Welcome to another exciting episode and interview of Kung Fu Conversations with the world-renowned, legendary, amazing, and all those other things that I can't think of right now, Dr. Mark Ching. Dr. Mark, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
I'm honored. Now, with an intro like that, I'm going to have to work really hard to live up to it.
So let's just say that somebody has been living under a rock. Who knows? It's 2023 now. So just in case anybody has been living under a rock, would you tell us some of your martial background?
I kind of resemble that remark. So, gosh, as far as my martial arts background, I would say that my initial training, my earliest years were in traditional Chinese martial arts, Shaolin and Taiji. I actually started Taiji with my dad when I was 10. And then since moving out to LA, I've had the privilege of studying with a whole bunch of different teachers, from Shotokan legend Tsutomu Oshima to the late Professor Dan Lee, Bruce Lee student, who's also one of my Taiji teachers, to a couple different Suijiao masters, Dr. Daniel Wang, plus the late Grandmaster David Lin. Fat Ga Kun from Sifu Arthur Lee, the late Grandmaster Arthur Lee. As far as Chinese martial arts, that as far as other martial arts and what I'm doing now, I try and spend my time, my training time these days is pretty much either with Sifu James Lin, who's Grandmaster David Lin's elder son, doing combat Suijiao, or at the Inosano Academy, training directly with Guru Dan Inosano. And then whenever I can outside of that, I try and make some time to train either with Tom Muzilla Sensei in Shotokan, or Martin Wheeler, one of my favorite teachers in Sistema, and as well as Aikido under Matsuoka Haruo Sensei and Josh Gold.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. That's pretty impressive. I've seen you do Siunim Tao a few times. Did you learn that under Sifu Dan or Guru Dan?
No, actually, Guru Dan's never taught me any forms, any sets per se. So the Siunim Tao that I've done, I think the one that I think you're referring to, the one that's on Instagram, that I actually learned from Randy Williams.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there was a period of time during around the mid 90s. Whenever Randy would come to LA, I would pick him up at the airport and he'd stay at my place. When he was, I think shooting, I can't remember which of the series he was shooting or if he'd already shot some of his video. Like he had one video series that he did through Unique Publications. That was the parent company of Inside Kung Fu. And I think he had something like 26 volumes or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Enormous.
Enormous and very encyclopedic. And if you actually have access to his books that he wrote in, I think he wrote them and shot them all in Singapore. The footage, all of the stills, it's incredible. It's like probably one of the most well thought out encyclopedic series you're going to find on Wing Chun, or at least on his interpretation of Wing Chun. So yeah, I was really fortunate to steal some time with him.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So I'm a little dumb to Fat Ga. Would you kind of explain that style a little bit? Because I know it's a Southern art, I'm guessing. So
Yep. So Fat Ga, believe it or not, it's interesting. Like when I've looked through the web, there are so many different styles, so many different systems that use the term or use the labeling Fat Ga. Fat in Cantonese means Buddha. Ga meaning family, so style. So to say that, I guess in broad terms, to say that you're doing Fat Ga or Buddha style means that you're doing a style that's got some derivation from Shaolin or some sort of Buddhist background. The version that I was fortunate enough to learn came via Hawaii. So the grandmaster I studied under was the late Arthur Lee. And he studied under Lam Dayung, who spent some time in Shaolin. So from what I understand, Lam Dayung's Patga, if you look at it, it draws elements from the five main southern styles, southern Kung Fu styles, Choi, Hong, Lao, Lei, and Mo. So if you look at all those five, you will see elements of them within our Patga. There are other styles that also refer to themselves as Patga, and I haven't had the privilege of studying them, so I can't really comment on them, but they all pretty much have that same kind of, like, there's something about them that's definitely an intrinsic southern style.
And would you characterize any of those styles? What would the similarities be, or what, you know, sort of the glaring differences inside of the Patga?
I mean, I it's hard for me to comment on because I haven't really spent a whole lot of time really studying what those other systems of Patga are like.
Sure.
So I can't. It's tough for me to. Yeah, it's really tough for me to comment on that. So yeah.
I've got one for you. So on the southern side of things, have you looked at anything like a Mukka or a Chuga or some of the other Hunga and seen some of the similarities maybe in the other southern styles to the Patga?
Oh, Hunga for sure. Chuga, as far as like the Tonglong, the praying mantis style, I've not seen any of the stuff that I consider like, oh, that's definitely so like some trademark Chuga, Tonglong, whatever, right? I haven't seen any of that in Patga Kun, but yeah. But like Hong Kun, for sure. Stuff that looks like Chole Fat, for sure. I mean, like, you'll see a lot of crossover with Chole Fat and Patga because there's that common Fat term in there. Right. But the Choi also as well. Because I'm not well schooled on what does like Lao Ga, Lei Ga, or Mok Ga look like, especially Mok Ga, because Mok Ga, I'm not really like, I mean, I've seen, just from curiosity, I've looked on YouTube and seen like, what are some different versions of Mok Ga? And like, I don't see a similar thread other than it just looking like someone doing sets. So like, if there's a binding logic, I'm not privy to it yet.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Dan Lee. Would you talk about his Tai Chi a little bit?
He was probably the first teacher that really made me think in terms of teaching, like the importance of really having a very well thought out progression to teach. So in other words, like instead of just follow me through this form or just follow me doing this is, you know, like old style masters oftentimes in the park, they're there to practice. You just try and follow along as much as you can. You know, it's like a kind of a monkey see monkey do kind of thing. Right. And then if you demonstrate that you're serious enough, then maybe you're going to hear a few words of correction. Right. Professor Lee was totally the opposite. It was sort of like, here are the things you need to look out for. Here's how you practice. Here are the details. And so because of that, I think the people that were fortunate enough to learn from him really understood what to look out for. So instead of just kind of like, oh, I'm moving slow and I don't really know what I'm doing and what, you know, he's like, this is what you're doing. This is why you're doing it. There's a logic. So I really credit him for showing me what a martial arts teacher could be like as an educator.
Oh man, that is big.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, he's super educated, probably one of the most educated guys I had the privilege of training with. In addition to his work as an engineer for JPL, you know, aerospace guy. I mean, he's brilliant as a professional, but as a martial artist, as someone that wanted to study Chinese medicine, he also, I think a lot of people don't know that I don't remember if he just had his licensure or if he also had his doctorate in Chinese medicine. So this is a guy that's very, very schooled, very intelligent, and very academic in his approach. So yeah, I was really lucky to have the time that I did with him.
And what would you say like a typical class would have looked like, you know, when you were going regularly?
At Dan Lee's?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Typical class would have been, you go in to the cultural center, you warm up and then it's like Tai Chi for however long. And then you're working whatever section that you're on. Like you're either, if the new people are working on section one, the slightly less new people are doing section one, section two. All sure. the, and like everyone would start together and then people would break off. So like the section one people would go break off after they hit where they would know and then they'd work on that part. The section two people would do the same, three, blah, blah, blah. Four would go all the way through the whole set, and then like the super advanced people would then break off at the end, having done the whole set once, then would go and work on either push hands or weapons or something else.
Hmm. Cool. Thank you.
I think if I recall correctly, there were times when he had some of the seniors that were there doing like Bagua as well. So.
Oh, wow. Was that primarily Yong style that he was teaching?
Yeah. Yeah. That's correct. Primarily Yong style. He did. During class, I do remember seeing some, like there were some times when he was teaching Chen style as well, but yeah, mostly Yang.
Owen and I have a joke between each other that we need to get engineering degrees because a lot of the great Chinese masters that are excellent teachers just happen to be engineers.
I think a lot of them actually managed to get jobs over here or get make headway in terms of immigration because they were engineers. So I think that may have fast-tracked their immigration status.
Sure.
Owen?
Go.
Okay. It's been almost 25 years since Combat Tai Chi.
Yeah.
Was released. And it just had a big new release, like a reboot, if you will.
Quite a shock.
Are you thrilled about that? A couple questions on it and then let you go. Who were your Tai Chi influences? Why did you think that that was a series that needed to be made at the time? And I've got to be honest with you, those videos might be more relevant now than they were when they were released. What do you think about that, Don?
I want to hear that. I'm going to turn the questioning back around to you.
Sure.
Because I've got to hear, why do you think they're more relevant now than ever before? That fascinates me, man.
I honestly think that. So I've been involved with the Wong Q lineage of Wing Chun. This next month will be 25 years, and I've had the privy of pushing hands, in a kind fashion, not in a rude way, with a lot of different people, and a lot of my friends that have done Tai Chi have almost walked away or washed their hands of it completely working with other people. Because when I started back in 98, back at Mesa in Grand Junction, Colorado, doing the Wing Chun Club, a lot of the Tai Chi guys that I knew, whether they be Yong, I knew a lot of Wu guys over there. Mm-hmm. They were throwing people around. They knew how to throw a punch. They know how to take a kick, those kind of things. And these days, you know, again, the ones that still practice, you know, they're like, it's just a bunch of pudding, you know, everybody's either too soft, like overcooked noodles, or they have no concept of what, the combat application of is of any of it. You know, they kind of feel like it's been, kind of over westernized and turned into something that is just for health and has no martial application. So at least from some of the people that I still talk to when I started training the Wing Chun almost 25 years ago, that's what the, you know, I only know a few people that actually know how to use it in a martial aspect. And here's another thing too. I've got some friends that do, you know, karate, they do some judo and things like that. And they'll have, folks that teach Tai Chi in their school. And they'll be like, oh, this is what we think that you're doing. This is what we think that you're doing. And so they'll add on application for like a one-to-one. It's like, oh, you know, wild horse parts of Maine. It's like, oh, well, this kind of looks like this. So are they doing a Tai Chi application or are they adding on something that kind of looks like the movement? Are they using a Tai Chi power or are they kind of doing something that kind of looks like Tai Chi, you know? So
interesting. Interesting. Yeah, I'm curious about that too. I mean, I've seen people show applications before of different martial arts. I mean, we don't have to talk specifically Tai Chi. I mean, like I've certainly seen people show applications of kata in like Shotokan and been sure. Like,
what?
I don't see where that movement that you're talking about in the form is what you're demonstrating, but sure, whatever. If it works for you, great. Honestly, I think when it comes to applications, there are a lot of people that gain inspiration for a particular technique that they do from the form. And I don't know for a fact that what they're doing is like, okay, this is what you're supposed to be doing in the form. And the biomechanics look similar. Mm. Like for Part Wild Horse's Mane, right? Like if you look at that, like if you understand the difference in terms of ranging, right? That could be a couple different applications. Absolutely. So what a lot of people think of in terms of applications is, oh, there's one move, there should be one application. The world is not that like binary. Do you know what I'm saying? Like there's spectrums. So for example, if you're in a particular range at a particular angle, it could be this application. If you're in a slightly different range, like you're in a little bit closer, it's a different application. If you're even further, it's like, it's something else. So like, if you look at it from long range, medium range, close range, right? What's long range? Usually striking or evading, right? What's medium range? Usually striking or capturing. What's close range? Capturing or grappling, right? So like we have to be able to look at the form as a codex. Like what does the codex offer us in terms of options? And that's limited by your experience. Mm-hmm. You know, if you haven't had the time or you haven't had the opportunity to be able to work techniques at those ranges with different people, you won't know what the hell it's for. And you'll be, and then at that point, it just becomes a health exercise, which is great. No knock against the health. However, I feel like when you have the intent of the movements in terms of self-defense, then you have a greater spectrum available to you. Like you can rev it up or you can tone it down depending on whatever situation you find yourself in. So to me, that's why I approach Tai Chi the way I do. And, you know, my father, like I think I told you guys, I started with my father. He was my first Tai Chi teacher. The thing that got me into Tai Chi was not the form. Like, as I'm watching him move slowly, I'm like, you know, as a little kid, especially, you're looking at that going like, this looks like some bullshit. So, and yeah. And then it just becomes, as a kid, you know, like I tell the story quite often, like as a kid, me looking at him as he was doing the set, and just watching, it just looked so weird that I had to work hard at not laughing. And of course, a little kid, if you're trying to not laugh, it's like trying to hold back wild horses. There's no way you're going to do that. So I bust out laughing and my dad's there like, what's so funny? And he's like, this is martial art. And I'm like, and that to me, that thought that was martial art was even funnier. So I laughed even harder. And he goes, all right, here, throw a punch. So I go, really? He goes, yeah, throw a punch. You know how to throw a punch. I was like, all right. Boom. And he's like, whoop, and sent me sailing. And I remember like, it felt so soft when he received and so like, I don't know. I don't even know where the word to describe it. It just felt like I was carried, you know, mm-hmm. when he sent me flying. I was just like, what the hell? Okay. I want to learn this. I really want to learn this. So that I think because I got into Tai Chi from being hooked from the applications, that colored my experience for the rest of my life.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. And so cool. Like even one of the things that I remember, there were a bunch of people in Professor Lee's class that were there Dan Lee's class, that were there just to learn the form because they wanted to appreciate the artistic experience of the form, the health aspects of the form, things like that. And I remember I was the pain in the ass young kid who was always like, Sifu, what's the application? Sifu, what's the application? Sifu, what's the application? And like, they were like, kid, shut up. So yeah.
Good for grilling them. Good for, being the loud kid in the room.
I couldn't help myself. I mean, I'm still that way when I get excited.
Mr. Schilling?
No, you know, I was actually, when you said that, I was like, well, you know, what's exciting you these days? You know,
oh, man.
Yeah.
Dude, I don't know where to start. I mean,
good.
You know, the names that I mentioned at the beginning when you guys asked me, like, if, you know, about the Living Under the Rock thing. God, any one of these people that I get to spend time with is enough for me to just, like, I could take a deep dive with any one person for years and not run out. Like, you know, since moving out to – go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Guru Dan. How long have you been working with Guru Dan? And how has he influenced? Because, I mean, my God, he's influenced, I feel like, everybody in the martial world. And, you know, almost anybody under a rock knows who Dan Inosanto is. How long have you been working with him? And what things – because I know Dan has a plethora of things to work with. What has really inspired you about Guru Dan? And how has he kind of changed things on maybe how you teach? Anything like that?
Oh, man. That could be an – I kid you not. That could be an episode unto itself.
Episode. I know.
I kid you not. I mean, he's – man, where do I start? The things that he is not credited for that he was actually like the source of or the guy that brought these changes about, man, I could number them and it would blow your damn mind. I mean, aside from teaching Bruce Lee, the nunchucks, you know, which, and also teaching Bruce Colley, there's so much stuff like the kicking shield. Bruce Lee would practice with, actually came from Guru Inosanto because they were using that as a football blocking shield back in the day. And so like, you know, for football players before they had like a, you know, those shields mounted up on,
the stands,
sleds, like a sled that you could, you know, the tackling guys could work, down the field. They used to be handheld back in the day. So like, Guru saw that and was like, he brought it to Bruce and was like, hey, I think we can practice with this thing. And Bruce was like, oh, this could be fun. So, I mean, there's so many instances like that. Man, so many instances throughout history. So Guru's influence, and because he's so low key and so chill and so not hungry for that recognition, when he doesn't get it or when people don't know it, he's just like, whatever, it's no big deal. And I've been really lucky to spend time with him kind of off the mat, like quite a lot of it off the mat. I got to know him as a patient. One of his teachers, the late, Pac Victor Dutoirs.
Yeah.
Of Silat Serap. Pac Vic was a patient of mine at the time. And, he says, you need to treat one of my students. I'm like, I'd be glad to, sir. I think you know him. His name is Dan Inosanto. And I'm like, well, I definitely know that name, sir. And then, like, I think a week or two later, Guru called me up and, you know, came in for an appointment. And so we started off with him as a patient of mine. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because, like, talking about crazy – I mean, dude, when I think about the stuff as – when I think about some of this stuff as a kid, like, for me as a kid, and if – you had told me when I was 16, hey, man, you're going to be treating someone with injuries that were caused by Bruce Lee. I would have been like, no way. just unthinkable. And so, like, I remember one of the first times when Guru came in, he was telling me about lower back pain. And I was like, can you tell me about your lower back history? You know, like, how long has this been hurting? He said, actually, doc, I think it started in, like, late 60s, maybe about 69. I took a really hard fall on a stage. It was a wooden stage. And as he started talking to me about it, I'm like, this is the picture. And I hope you can find it for the podcast audience. There's a still where Bruce Lee is doing a throw and Guru's wearing a white gi. And Guru's like a few feet off the ground. And it's like, you can see Guru vertical and Bruce is throwing him downward. And that was the start. And he was telling me about, and I'm thinking, I'm listening to this going like, as I'm hearing him describe the situation of how he got injured, I'm like, I think I know what you're talking about. And it was really wild. I don't have any words other than really wild to describe it. Just unbelievable. Unbelievable. So yeah, I got to know him. I think he came in either 04 or 05. I can't remember. I want to say 04, 03, 04, somewhere in there. Time is kind of a blur these days.
Yeah, that's 20 years ago, Doc. I get it.
Yeah, man. So, that's when he came in, and then, you know, he kept inviting me. He's like, Doc, if you want to come in to train at the academy, come in. And I just, you know, I have such a reticence when it comes to being opportunistic, especially when it comes to people being kind to me or generous with me who are my patients. I'm like, oh, I can't. And I know for a fact, like with him, he's one of these guys that's crazy generous, like generous to a fault. And if he didn't have people watching out for him, he's so good hearted that he would give away the clothes on his back, that kind of guy. And so like every time he'd invite me to come to train at the academy, I'm like, no, I can't. And then finally, I can't remember who I was talking to, a friend of mine or a colleague. And they were like, dude, you've been wanting to train with meet this guy, never mind train with this guy, for like the majority of your life. Why don't you just do it? And I was like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. So then I think it was like maybe 06 or so, shortly before the birth of my son, maybe late 05, that I actually went into the academy and joined up and then started training. And I've been there since.
That's amazing.
As far as what of the many things that how Guru influences me, gosh, I in so many different ways. I mean, I think in the most powerful way is he drives me to look for ways of being a better person. The grace with which he handles so much. I mean, I don't know what the right word is to say. I mean, like, he handles so much, whether it be from people that are running their mouths that don't know anything about him or Bruce Lee or whatever. And then they're like yapping about him, and how he just handles it with such cool, like he doesn't handle it with condescension. He doesn't handle it by having to snap back or clap back at people. He's so classy and chill and so forgiving of a guy that, you know, I feel a lot about him as I feel it like with my own dad. I mean, like I've often said about my own dad that if the day when I kick the bucket, if I'm like 5% of the guy that my dad is, then wow, I'll be thrilled. And it's the same with Guru.
Is your dad still with us?
Yes, thank goodness.
And is he still doing Tai Chi? Are you guys still doing Tai Chi now and then?
Sorry, give me one second.
You're good.
My daughter just pinged me and I just want to answer this. She's like, you know, like with the iPhone and the Apple devices, you can have like multiple do not disturb, like absolutely do not disturb, whatever things. With my kids, no matter what, if they ping me, I'll answer. So
good. Are you still doing Tai Chi with Dad every now and then?
Once in a while, I try and get Dad to train, but he's 96 now. So like,
oh wow,
yeah, he's happy just to be up and shuffling around the house. So
that's a good thing, right? That's
yeah,
great.
Yeah. So I mean, for him, it's more like at this stage in the game, just because he's been sedentary for a while too. Like let me backtrack a bit. Pre-pandemic, he was out here visiting with my mom. He and my mom were out here, and he was just getting over a flu. And they were on their daily walk going, like, the area that I live in is rather hilly. And so they were coming up one hill and my dad was going forward to press the, cross the street button, the stop sign button or whatever it's called. I don't remember, like the thing to trigger the light to change. Mm-hmm. And he said, as he went forward to go to press the button, he said he couldn't figure out why he was moving backwards. And he fainted. He passed out and hit his head. So he had a skull fracture. So, and that was, I think, 3 years ago. So 2019. So yeah, almost 4 years ago now. And so since then, he hasn't been his usual self as far as movement goes. He's still been mobile. I mean, he can still squat rock bottom, but all of his movements are much more ginger now. So I'm glad to still have him with us. He's still functional. He's still conversational. But his memory isn't quite what it was. And certainly his mobility, having been laid up for a while, isn't quite what it was either. So yeah, at this stage, I'm just trying to keep him mobile and have him do groundwork. So not groundwork in terms of jiu-jitsu, but groundwork in terms of exercises and mobility, so that his joints stay somewhat functional and that his core stays active.
Nice. That's a very cool approach. Because yeah, my father-in-law, he's older as well. So it's like, it could be good to just have something like that as a resource in terms of, you know, just basic exercises about getting up and being on the ground and keeping your core engaged. And yeah.
100%. Yeah. I mean, simple things. I mean, simple, but not easy, especially if you're already operating from a point where like you can't do some of these positions or you can't do some of these exercises. Luckily, my dad still has access to all of those ranges, although it's just not the most strength or not the most control. So I said, Dad, like every day, if you can, you know, I took my old bedroom, the master bedroom in the house, and converted it to a spa. So like now there's a hyperbaric chamber in there. There's a treatment table. There's an inversion table. It's kitted out.
Well, that's pretty sweet.
I bled some pennies for that. quite a few. And part of the area is matted floor. So like I said, I want you ideally to be able to lie down on this mat, get up, reach for the ceiling fan, and then lie back down and do that 20 times every day. If you can do that 20 times a day with relative ease, that's going to keep you in the game longer. Whereas if you just sit in front of the TV,
yeah,
we're going to have problems. Or if you're just going to fall asleep in a recliner,
yeah,
there are going to be some problems.
It sounds like a non-kettlebell Turkish getup almost.
It pretty much is. Like it's funny. There are certain things that he'll do as far as movement or as far as with the resistance. But if I put a weight in his hand, he's like, "Oh, it's too heavy." So, like, rather than arguing with him about that, I'll just get him to do movements that approximate the benefits that I want, without having to run into that kind of resistance from him.
Sure. That's a cool strategy.
Yeah. I think that path of least resistance thing is one that I've been a little bit slow to the game to adopt.
Owen?
Randall?
Yes, sir. Any questions?
No. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm loaded over here. I've got all the good stuff, Doc.
Fire, man.
Where did your kettlebell journey begin? And you went pretty far down that rabbit hole with one of the guys that basically brought it over here to the West.
Yes. So like a lot of things in my life, especially in the latter half of my life, my kettlebell journey started at the Inosano Academy, believe it or not.
Wow.
Guru came to me one time at the office and was like, Doc, I have a favor to ask of you. I'm like, name it. Anything you want. And he goes, can you come to the academy? I'm like, sure, I'll come to the academy. What's the situation? He goes, well, one of my students got me these training sessions with this Russian weight training coach. And you've just got like, my back has been bothering me for decades and you've got me like relatively pain free. Like I want it to stay that way. I really don't care to have my back messed up, you know, like by overtraining or hurting myself or doing whatever. So like, as a medical voice in the room, would you mind coming just so, like, if you see something that is off or is dangerous or whatever, you object on my behalf? And if for some reason I happen to get hurt, you're already there so you can put me back together. I go, sure. So I pull into the parking lot. We're waiting for Guru. And then who rolls up but Pavel Tsitsulin himself? And I was just like, I think I've seen that guy's face on some ads in the magazine or something like that. And he opens up his trunk, pulls out some kettlebells and walks in. I'm like, yeah, I've seen him before. And then that was my first introduction to Pavel at the Inostato Academy.
Wow.
Interestingly enough, the more I heard Pavel speak, the less I thought I was sitting in on a weight training session than observing a master at rehabilitative exercise. So the more I heard him speak, the more I heard Pavel cue and ask Guru to do certain exercises, the more I thought, wow, this is stuff that if every MD, every DO, every medical professional had to experience or had some background in, wow, what a different kind of healthcare we would see right now. And I certainly thought that so much of what I'd just heard from Pavel that first day as a clinician, I was like, man, I can't wait to go try this shit myself and actually do this with my patients. So yeah, that's how my journey started.
Do you think that the strength training that a kettlebell can offer people, how do I say this? I have some friends that have done, you know, nothing but, like, let's say a Kenpo or a karate style. And they're like, oh, this keeps me in shape. This keeps me in shape. This keeps me in shape. And I'm a short, little chubby round guy, so I can't say a whole lot, but they're using their martial art just for the health practice. And a lot of people in martial arts seem to be very opposed to weightlifting, but something as dynamic, especially if it's taught correctly, as the kettlebell, do you think that that can fill a gap or a void that a lot of classical martial artists just aren't getting in their art?
It's tough to say, because if you look at arts like Shuai Jiao, Chinese wrestling, sure, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The stone lock training is almost identical to what you'd see in terms of kettlebells. Okinawan Goju-ryu, you'll see people working with Qixi and other weighted, yep, exercise. So I don't know that, like, a martial art per se is going to forbid weightlifting or run counter to weightlifting. I think it's the style of weightlifting that's important to consider. So if you're training weightlifting in a way that you're just trying to build hypertrophy, with no sense of responsibility in terms of pain-free range of motion, in terms of flexibility, in terms of, like, ease of movement, and just looking for size, and also not being considered in terms of, like, how that extra mass may affect your movement in terms of speed, then we have a problem, a potential problem. But I think otherwise, I don't see an issue with weight training. If you look at a lot of the old time Tai Chi guys, even they would do movement just to build strength, with different kinds of weights or different kinds of resistance. So I don't see what the issue is. I think a lot of that is just, an incomplete picture, unfortunately, some folks have carried forth, and some of it is just because opinions have gotten lost in translation as well. So some of that is just the unfortunate outcome of monoglot culture.
You have a unique perspective, because I feel like you have a good grasp of Western and Eastern medicine. What are some things that both of these styles of medicine can bring to the table and have a conversation about? How do they help augment each other? Are they completely opposing each other, or where can they find a middle ground to have a good conversation? What are the pros and cons of each, if you will?
Man, that's a superb question. I think the younger me was pretty ignorant, and said that there were, like, it's, you know, playing it out like team A, team B, and they're, you know, they're never in the middle shall they meet. And that was pretty myopic and pretty inexperienced and juvenile of me. Looking at it from the perspective that I have now, I think it's just like two different languages. Like we're speaking different languages with different perspectives and different influences with the same goals, right? The goal is to be able to treat the human body, to be able to improve the human body, to be able to reduce pain, to be able to help the body overcome disease. It's just the methods are different. And I think if we spent less energy on, you know, picking at each other and started looking carefully at like, what are the paradigms in which we can piggyback with each other better, we'd have a better result. For example, like, let's see. Okay, let's look at back pain, right? Western lower back pain treatments oftentimes for an inexperienced clinician, right, will be, okay, take a muscle relaxant, take a pain reliever or whatever, assuming that the x-ray or assuming that the imaging is clean, like assuming that there's no reason to fear that there's a fracture or some sort of tumorous growth or some sort of osteoporosis, anything architectural like that, assuming none of those major cases is going on, then oftentimes the average clinician is going to be like, here, take two of these Advil and call me in the morning. And unfortunately, that doesn't really help the patient feel better. Now, a little bit more experienced clinician, whether it's an MD, a DO, DC, whatever the designation is, a little bit more experienced clinician might be able to say like, okay, let's see how you move. Let me have you reach for your toes. Let me see you put your arms overhead and reach backwards. Let me see you turn left and right. Okay, you have a little bit of a movement asymmetry. You have a bias towards this. And some of that tension is causing you pain here, here, and here. So let me have you do these exercises. And if these exercises can get you greater range of motion and have you feeling better, then let me have you doing those. I mean, we can't say that that's Western or Eastern. That's just like, that's just simply paying attention to what the patient is coming in with and not being lazy and saying like, here are two muscle relaxants, here are two anti-inflammatories, call me in the morning. I mean, pharmaceutical culture is easy, but it's not necessarily sustainable, nor is it complete. Similarly, like exercise or corrective exercise or restorative exercise culture isn't complete either. Someone comes in with a gunshot wound, no damn way I'm going to have them doing deadlifts. So we need to be more intelligent about how we triage our patients. And I think a lot of that isn't going to happen until like insurance changes how they bill, you know, how doctors and practitioners get compensated.
Wow. Super wise. That's awesome. Awesome. Thank you.